Greetings, all my lovelies. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. This week, I interview Tristan Van Cleve, and we talk a little bit about what happens when you start a meditation practice, and then you keep going and going, and how both your body and your mind change over time. His experience is fascinating, and I can't wait for you to hear his story. I'd like to thank everyone for the ratings and reviews you've left me. If you haven't yet, please consider giving the podcast a rating. It helps other people find us. And you know what else helps other people find us? Sharing the love. If you know someone who's going through a hard time or needs a little pick-me-up, needs a little brightness in their day, suggest the podcast. Go up to them, kind of, you know, sashay on over and say, "Hey, you look like you're having a bad day." You know what will help you believe in the world again? It's this little thing called Bite-Sized Blessings Podcast. Go ahead. I dare you. Do it. Thanks for coming back again this week, listeners, and diving into episode 124. Once again, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I think you will too. So without further ado, episode 124 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
I woke up from a dead sleep, and there was a young woman standing right beside my bed, like maybe between 20 and 25. And I instinctively like recoiled in fear and like gasped. And I was just staring at her, and she had long, dark, curly hair. She was holding a little dog in her arms, and she was just looking at me. And then she faded into nothingness before my eyes. I try to avoid self-describing, honestly. No, like, I'm being serious. I guess I am who I am. I feel like I'm a very flexible person, okay? I don't know. I feel like I try to avoid getting too attached to like certain aspects of my personality. And I try and stay open to shifting and changing and letting parts of myself go. So I just kind of hope that, you know, the impression that I make on other people shines through positively, you know, and if not, just kind of correct as I go. So yeah, I don't know how well that would go over at a party, but I could try that one out. How do you describe yourself? Well, I try not to be attached to me.
Did you move here for school, or how did you end up moving here?
I ended up here, which is a pretty common thing. I don't know. There wasn't really like a logical rhyme or reason, besides I had family here and I was like, sure, I'll come try it out. And here we are, 6, 7, 8, however many years later, with a bachelor's degree from New Mexico. So, you know, there you go.
So has your family been here for hundreds of years?
Actually, maybe. Okay. So this is funny. Okay. So years and years ago, I used to do some work at the Santa Fe Playhouse, right? And they used to have a picture of like the first, someone could probably fact check me on this because I don't know, but I think it was like the first acting troupe at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And there was a dude in that picture named Gene Van Cleve with my spelling. And my spelling is actually pretty uncommon, and the name itself is uncommon. So I haven't been able to track this down, and honestly, I forgot about it until you asked me. But it's possible that yes, but I don't know.
Van Cleve is such an interesting last name. Do you know where that comes from?
I mean, I have family legends, but I don't know anything for sure. What I think I know is that on my dad's side, my great-grandfather was an orphan. and he was given the name Van Cleve in the orphanage, or maybe by someone who adopted him or something like that. So that's what I know or think I know. But honestly, I really don't know. And it's not a super common name. And the little bit of poking around I've done, I haven't found too much information on it.
Yeah, it's a really unusual last name. I mean, it's so, for me, it's just so aristocratic. And so I thought, oh, maybe you have a castle somewhere in Europe.
Could be. I mean, that would be cool. I mean, all I know for sure is that it's Americanized Dutch, because V-A-N is Dutch, V-O-N is German.
I was going to say, you do look a tad Dutch.
Yeah, it's probably in there somewhere.
You're probably a mutt like the rest of us.
Yeah, most likely. Most likely.
So did you grow up in a religious household in Oregon? Was your family religious?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, they were. They were. Not really a strict denomination, though. It was kind of, so like looking back as an adult and what I now know about, you know, different religious sects within like the Judeo-Christian sphere, it was definitely a blend of like several different Christian sects. So like there was some Catholic influence in there, possibly some Latter-day Saints influence in there. There was a lot of emphasis on like, you know, objects and or people possibly being possessed by demons and malicious spirits and stuff like that. Absolutely Christian in the sense that, like, you know, Jesus was seen as like, he died, he was resurrected, and he will return to earth again to usher in the end of days. A lot of emphasis on the apocalypse and stuff like that, which makes it lean more towards like the Latter-day Saints-y territory.
Well, was that scary for you as a child, just to have all these, I mean, just having in your reality the possibility that others around you can be possessed by demons, I think would be terrifying.
Well, it definitely was. I mean, there was definitely like this low-grade paranoia about, you know, second-guessing your behavior, because, you know, maybe your behavior is yours, or maybe it's the influence of some malicious spirit that's attached itself to you. So yeah, I mean, that was definitely there. And I think in my early childhood, it definitely created something in me that was like looking for the demons, you know, in others and in things, you know, looking over my shoulder, what was it, you know, that kind of thing.
That sounds so traumatic.
I mean, ultimately, you know, I think it was a good thing. But yeah, at the time it was terrifying. What really terrified me as a child was the prospect of, you know, the apocalypse. Because that is not, it's not a very nice book, the Book of Revelations. Like, you know, blood raining from the sky and the armies of the earth rising up and a beast with 14 heads being ridden by a harlot to destroy the world, and men with the face of locusts, you know, in this cyclone of pain and destruction. It's just horrifying. You know, as an adult looking back, like, it's interesting, it's beautiful. But when you take that literally, I mean, like, not only if you believe in that literally, it's like, not only is the world ending, it's like ending in the worst possible way. It's like, not only are you going to die, you're going to suffer for eternity. And also your last moments on earth are going to be horrifying. You know,
I see that you still remember some of the passages quite well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was read the book more than once. And then also I studied it briefly as an adult in college, because I took a class on the Bible as literature. And also, you know, now that I've kind of like reconciled the fear of it that I've had as a child, I think it's one of the more interesting books in the Bible. Also historically, because I'm no expert on this, but I think there's some historic evidence that the book was possibly written as like a political attack on the Emperor Nero in Rome.
I love that. So potentially propaganda.
Yeah. Yeah. well, for better or for worse. I mean, apparently Nero was kind of a horrible emperor. Yes, yeah, no, it's a very interesting book. More so interesting that there are a lot of people that think that it is what will literally happen. And typically they think it's what will literally happen tomorrow, because the end of days is always coming tomorrow. You know, that's how it tends to work under that belief structure. Like, we are always living in the end times.
Which is so depressing to me, because just living with that mentality kind of takes all the hope and joy out of the world, you know? Although I guess you could argue for them, that's where their hope and joy is, that everything will end and all the people will get left behind and suffer terrible fates and they'll get saved. So that's where their hope and joy is for everyone, all the unbelievers, all the people who aren't good enough, they get left behind to be tortured and tormented, but they're special and they get to go somewhere else. Can you tell that I'm a little jaded about this or a little annoyed?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, because that is, I mean, I also find it sad because that does seem to be the emotional attachment to the apocalypse in these different Christian sects. It's, you know, it's the meek will inherit the earth. It's like, I have lived this life of, you know, self-mortification because I'm preparing for the end of days where I get the ultimate reward and all the people that were mean to me get punished. But it's really unnecessary. And actually, this emphasis on the end of days is ultimately, like, it was one of the linchpins that led to me becoming an atheist as a teenager and turning away from, you know, the faith that I was raised in, because I would consider myself to be raised Christian just by process of learning more about the religion and looking back and just fitting the pieces together. But a very common way to be raised is, you know, Jesus is love, Jesus is forgiveness, Jesus is ultimate, you know, the ultimate love, the ultimate forgiveness, what have you, what have you. But then if you take something like this seriously, it created this, like, this logical dilemma in my head as a kid. I'm like, but wait, if Jesus is all love and all forgiveness, but the world is destined to end, but not only destined to end, it's destined to end in this horrifying way, then in a roundabout way, it led me to the conclusion that that means that God has created some people strictly for the purpose of being punished at the end of days. And then also, it's like how radical certain people get about sin. It's like, even at like 7, 8 years old, I was like, there's no way I'll get into the kingdom of heaven. It's like, I've already sinned too much. How could I possibly ever be good enough? So really what was happening, which ultimately led to me becoming an atheist later, is I had this realization as a child that, like, in a sick sense, this God that was supposed to be all love and forgiveness created me so I would be thrown into a lake of fire when the world ends next week. So that, obviously, I couldn't reconcile those two things. So I ended up becoming an atheist when I was about 13, which kind of tracks with going through puberty and like, time to rebel. But then, you know, I became a pretty, you know, hardcore atheist, which comes with its own problems that will probably come up.
I do think it's interesting that there seems to be quite a large contingent of society, you know, in any religion, every kind of religion, belief system. Sometimes I feel like we create these religions so that we have a place to call home for our hearts, to have a community, to have people who are like-minded or, you know, we can feel safe with, no matter if it's our behaviors or our thoughts or what have you. But sometimes those communities kind of become super inward facing. And instead of, I don't know, every religion has a different belief system, but it really is to keep the other out. Essentially, that's what the religion becomes, the other with a capital O. And I just don't think that we can create heaven on earth when you're ostracizing and othering massive swaths of society. I don't know. That's just my, that's my soapbox for this week. My little soapbox.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that you're absolutely right, because especially within like this particular branch of religion, like Christianity in particular, to a lesser extent, some other associated religions, but there's a very clear in-group and out-group. And given the belief system, like the stakes on your soul for associated with the out-group is your soul, you know, it's eternal damnation. So it's like, I try to, I mean, it's been a long time since I've split with this, but I try to be very empathetic towards people who are still in that space, because in a sense, it's a kind of brainwashing, because you've created a belief system in which, unless you have some kind of realization that I did that helps you break away, I mean, you're being told that like, this is true. And if you stop believing that this is true, your destiny is eternal torment. And it's like, of course, it has to be the most absurd torment possible. I think, you know, it's been a while since I've read the Book of Revelations, but I think it's like, there will be a lake of fire and you will burn in it and be regenerated and burned again forever and ever and ever. And it'll never stop. So it's just like, I mean, the dude who was writing that, he was probably just cackling to himself. He's like, what's the most twisted thing I could think of? How about being burning alive forever? So my progression was kind of like, you know, I left the faith, I suppose, as a young teen, became a pretty hardcore atheist for the next 10 plus years. And that only, you know, compounded until I kind of reached like the logical limits of like a hard materialistic conception of reality, where it's like, you know, I got to the point where it was essentially like, I didn't believe in free will or even really agency anymore, because from like a very like strict materialistic conception of reality, everything kind of just becomes a domino effect. But that also has the unintended consequence on the individual of kind of taking away your sense of personal power and agency. So long story short, you know, it kind of reached a head where I was very depressed, very existentially anxious. Even though many aspects of my life were going very, very well, I was a very high performing student. And, you know, on the outside, everything looked like things were going well, but I was miserable. So I started meditating very diligently for like 2.5 years. You know, I downloaded the app, started doing it every single day. And at one point I looked through like the data on the app and I was so neurotic about it. In like 2.5 years, I'd only missed like 2 or 3 days. And I started noticing changes, like the anxiety and the depression. It started fading away and fading away. There was one day in particular where I remember I was so excited because it was like, it was the first time in years that I did not have a panic attack. And it was like, so that really started to shift my mindset to be more open about essentially the spiritual. How I would talk about it now is I would say, you know, mysticism/occultism, like these, and just the paranormal in general. I'm like, okay, so there's something to this. I'm like, I'm sitting here counting my breaths, but things are changing. But then, after about 2.5 years of meditation, something insane happened to me that just launched me into crazy town. So I woke up from a dead sleep and there was a young woman standing right beside my bed, like maybe between 20 and 25. And I instinctively like recoiled in fear and like gasped. And I was just staring at her. And she had long, dark, curly hair she was holding a little dog in her arms and she was just looking at me. And then she faded into nothingness before my eyes. It wasn't like a blink and you miss it moment. Like, she was there for like a solid 1 or 2 seconds. And then she faded away and was gone. And honestly, I couldn't reconcile it for quite a long time. I was like, am I having a psychotic break? You know, am I hallucinating? What is going on here? And, you know, really the only solace that I found is that I guess the fact that I'm questioning my sanity implies that I still have some kind of a grasp on reality. But I couldn't really reconcile the experience. And I still don't think that I can necessarily, but how that has changed me is it was kind of the evidence that I needed to take the next step. Because prior to that, even though I was meditating, and at that point I was a full-on Wim Hofer, I was taking ice baths every day and doing the breath work. I was doing all of these things that I would later discover are, you know, mystical techniques for enlightenment that have existed for thousands of years. Even though I was doing those things, I was still pretty closed off to most things, including the idea of ghosts and the paranormal, and especially astrology. You know, I'm not going to lie, in those days, I would have, you know, pretty openly made fun of people talking about astrology. I'm like, okay, well, you're an idiot, that's fine, whatever. But then karma comes back around, and now I'm the one asking everyone their sign. So that's how that works. It opened my eyes to the possibility that my previous conception of reality as this kind of open and shut book of just cause and effect was not entirely what was going on. So that led me to take some classes in mysticism and Eastern religion during the final semester of my undergraduate degree, which led to this big collection of books about it that I have above my laptop right now, and which has led to this constant searching. And I still, you know, I'm still hesitant to just accept beliefs. I still try to, I guess, be scientific. I tend to, you know, wait until whatever someone is telling me is validated by some kind of experience. But the funny thing that happens is that I tend to keep having experiences that suggest more strange things. Take like astrology. That was the longest, hardest sell for me. I was like, okay, fine, I'll accept ghosts, I'll accept whatever, but astrology is absolute horseshit. You cannot tell me that fucking Pluto has anything to do with how angry I get or whatever. But then, you know, I start learning more about it and I start getting deeper into it. And then I start having these weird experiences where I start having a really strange day. And then I check the astrology and I'm like, well, that's weird. How is this predicting the type of day that I'm having, even though I was unaware of this prior to checking it? I mean, it becomes stranger and stranger. So I've just reached a point where I'm like, I honestly have no idea what's going on, but I do know that there is far more to what's going on than I previously thought.
I was going to ask, I mean, when you first saw that girl next to your bed, was it scary? Were you scared?
It was absolutely petrifying. Like, it's actually really hard to describe the type of terror that I experienced. It was a confrontation with the impossible, which is far scarier than anything else. Because I've had other scary experiences. You know, shifty looking characters. I had this one guy try and, you know, threaten to shoot me at a gas station once. That's terrifying, but that's a different type of terror. That's like, holy crap. It fits within your previously established conception of reality that like that bear over there could attack me or this guy might threaten me. That's scary in that way. This is scary in a way where suddenly something that should be completely impossible based on my conception of reality has just confronted itself with me. And I, for the second time in my life, am left searching for a way to make sense of this, wondering if I'm crazy, because just like when I left the faith earlier, I had to accept that everything that I believed was not the case. Now I'm sitting here like something just appeared before me and evaporated into thin air. That is impossible, yet it happened. And there's nothing I can do to prove it besides just saying it. So yeah, it was absolutely petrifying. Also waking up and having a stranger just standing over you, staring at you, even if they have a very pleasant look on your face as this ghost woman did, that is also a little bit jarring, especially when you're not expecting anyone to be in your house at all. And they're watching you sleep. It's like, what do you want from me, lady?
I'm so curious because I've talked to other people who've seen ghosts, and sometimes when they see that initial visitor, they shut themselves off. And they don't see them for a long time. And they actually have to, you know, kind of consciously and very directly say, all right, I'm open to having that experience again. Was that your experience, or do you still see ghosts? How have you kind of found peace with it?
Well, I haven't seen any more apparitions since. That was the first and only time I've ever seen one in my life. But in terms of the openness to the experience, I think that there is something to that, because I've noticed that effect playing out in other spiritual, I guess, domains, where it seems like the only reason why something is not happening is because I'm not yet open to it happening yet. So for instance, low grade psychic phenomena. So this ghost woman experience that was between 1 and 2 years ago, thereabouts, we'll just say a year and a half to be safe. But as the journey's progressed since then, you know, I have uncanny experiences pretty frequently. It's, you know, just like low grade psychic things. It's like, oh, I'm thinking of something and then something appears. How funny is that? Did I predict it? Did I manifest it? How does this work? But I have noticed that as I open myself up more and more to the possibility of these things unfolding in my life, suspiciously, they tend to happen more often.
I used to work at this place in Portland that was in Northwest Portland. And it's on the very edge of kind of, I don't know if you'd call it civilization, but it very old land with a ton of history, lots of old Portland history. I believe at one of the buildings nearby, they'd had a massive fair like 150 years ago, something like that. So it was a real happening area 150 years ago. And I wouldn't, you know, when it was dead, I'd sit in the back and read a book, but I always keep my eye kind of looking out the front door to make sure that I'm not missing customers. And the amount of times out of the corner of my eye that I saw people walk by, dogs walk by, but they were like shades. It was almost like maybe seeing the past, like people walking by in the past. It happened so much. It was so distracting. And I just thought to myself, I don't even know what this is or what's happening. And just one day I said, stop it. I don't want to see this anymore. I'm done. And ever since then, I haven't seen it. But I wasn't scared or anything. It was like watching an old film reel or something like that. I don't know. Does that sound like something familiar to you?
I don't know. Because I don't know who or what this thing was. What's really interesting, and of course, memory gets funny, but she looked very much like someone that we both know, who I won't name, that we work with. And that also is very interesting to me. And you brought up time, like maybe you're seeing things throughout time. I don't really know, but it is conceivable And some physicists have, you know, I guess postulated that time might not really work in the linear way that we think it does. Like, it is possible that events don't necessarily unfold from A to B the way that we think that they do, but I guess for whatever reason, we experience it as if they do. So I don't know.
I think we experience it the way we do because we'd all go insane if we did not. Yeah, I don't think probably. Our consciousnesses yes. could handle it. But that's a really fascinating and also alarming experience. I too would be startled and or upset if there was a stranger standing next to me holding a dog next to the bed. That would probably be a little alarming. And yes, I love your use of the term uncanny, because for me, that's such a old-fashioned word, but it's so perfect for describing some of the things that people experience. It's just such an old-fashioned, interesting term. So thank you for using that word. It's totally perfect. Yeah.
I had that brief glimpse of this thing standing near my bed, and here I am all this time later following this thread, and I still can't let it go because there's a part of me that's trying to learn more, that's trying to figure it out, you know. And it's possible that what's out there is just beyond our understanding, or maybe you just have to accept it, maybe you have to be open to it, I don't know. But you know, something really strange that happens somewhat often is this bizarre, like, I don't really know how to describe it. Because as I said earlier, it's like, I try not to just adopt like beliefs and explanations for things. I know that there's people out there that have some pretty sophisticated systems of the magical and how things work. This is a shadow person. This is this, this is that. I think that's great. Maybe they're right, but I just try and keep myself open. But you know, there's this really interesting thing that happens to me and tends to happen more and more, where I think of something kind of passively, and then it just shows up in my life over and over again, sometimes in really, really, really bizarre ways. For example, recently, did you see my new car, the little red one? No? Okay. Well, I have a new little red car now. So 6 months ago, when I was leaving my graduate program, taking a sabbatical from that, I decided that this year I wanted to get a new car because the old car was getting old. It was almost 20 years old, had 260,000 miles on it. It was like, I knew eventually, like, nothing lasts forever. The poor thing was going to die. So 6 months ago, when I was kind of planning this year, I knew I wanted to get a new car. And I knew I wanted to get the exact car that I ended up getting. I wanted a Hyundai Elantra. I had specifications for how many miles I wanted it to have. There was a range of years that I wanted the car to be from. And the reason why is because newer cars, I'm not a car expert, but from what I've seen, cars past, like, I think 2016 or so, they have these super sophisticated computer systems. And for whatever reason, I just didn't want to deal with that because I'm kind of, I don't know, hesitant to change. I'm like, I just don't want my car to be so high tech that I can't just take it to a normal mechanic and get a belt fixed if I need to, you know? Or it's like, what if my car gets hacked? I don't know. That's probably paranoia. Maybe I should educate myself about computers. So anyway, so I had all these specifications for the damn car, right? And at the time, I had no idea how it was going to be possible. I was just like, I want to get this car, whatever. Put it out of sight, put it out of mind. So 2 weeks ago, I'm driving a friend of mine to the airport. My old car, the belt snaps. I guess on Hondas, there's like this main drive belt that controls like half the function of the car. That thing snaps on the freeway doing 85, tears a hole in the radiator, The car starts smoking, overheating, like it's out of commission. So I have to get towed all the way back home. And, you know, in the next 3 days, I've got a shift. I'm like, I need a car. And like, everyone I know is working. Everyone I know is busy. Like, I need a car now. I had a friend come and look at the car, and the damage was far worse than I could have anticipated. Like, the car was toast. So I'm like, okay, whatever. So I get on the internet and I'm just like looking for cars in Santa Fe. And there's a dealer here in Santa Fe. Because the other piece of this is that right now, the time that we're recording, the used car market is out of control. Like, used cars are very expensive right now. Don't know why, won't speculate. It's hard to get a car right now. So I'm looking online and there's one car in this dealer's catalog, exactly one, that is within my budget at this point in time. It is a Hyundai Elantra. It's within the year span that I'm looking for. And to make matters even stranger, it's red. The reason why that's strange is because both my younger brothers within the last month, both just got new cars. Both of them are red. So it's like, you know, you could come up with some kind of a logical explanation for why it's red, whatever. But at least in my mind, I'm like, okay, I guess this is my car and I don't really have a choice at this point. So then I fill out the financing form, you know, and my credit isn't perfect right now. And I'm a little bit financially overextended in some areas. So part of me was expecting to get denied. I got approved. And within 24 hours, I had the car and it's now sitting in my driveway. So weird things like that. It's like, you know, I did not take any deliberate action to make this car come into my life. Actually, the furthest thing from my mind was getting a new car because I just moved into a new house and I've got all this money out in different areas. I'm like, I can't afford a new car right now. I'm just going to drive this car into the ground. Well, in a very mysterious way, things transpire. And now I have the damn car that I asked for. But, you know, weird things like that. And it's like, I couldn't have possibly foreseen this. But then the funny thing is that if you look back on it retrospectively, it's like the only way that I would have been open to getting this new car that I wanted is if my other car would have broken down, because I'm stubborn. I wouldn't have done it. I was willing to drive that car into the ground before I got a new one. And that's exactly what I did. And then what pops up? The exact car that I asked for. And I have a journal sitting on my desk where I was just writing out the specifications for that damn car. And I love the car because it's weird.
Tristan, for sharing his stories and also for the magical kind of way he has in the world. Anyone else want a red car? I guess you'll just have to start meditating every day, and then suddenly, apparently, these things will come to you. I need to ask my listeners, please do consider supporting the podcast on Patreon. It's a sweet little site that allows listeners and supporters to donate a little bit each month, and all those little donations, they add up to so very much. Whether it's $3, $5, or $10 a month, please know, dear listeners, every little bit counts and every little bit matters so very much to me. There will be a link to my Patreon at the bottom of the episode's show notes. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Alexander Nakarada, Justin Allen Arnold, Tiagas, Thor Owak, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, artists, super groovy stuff, things I think will lighten and hopefully brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Tristan. Be ever inquisitive about the world. Meditate every day. Be committed. Be passionate about it. Meditate every day, never knowing exactly where it takes you. Of course, I don't want all of you to experience waking up and then finding someone stand over your bed, but who knows? Who knows where that meditation practice can take you? So be like Tristan. Commit to the practice, and then watch the magic unfold.